Did not our hearts burn within us as he spoke to us about the scriptures? To me, that's an aesthetic response. They were seeing Jesus before they even knew they were seeing him. They were seeing him with their heart, with that aspect of aesthetics that can touch us before our intellect gets hit. Well, I'd like to share an Emmaus moment with you, because when I saw this, I first just thought maybe the same thing you did. Ew, gross. And it's really big, too. It's about, you know, it's about this big. It's a giant dirty finger, you know? And if that wasn't enough, you know, to rub my face in it, Tim Hawkinson has made it with astonishingly convincing detail. It's made out of the same kind of material that, you know, those wax figures kind of trick you out with, so that you have to give a double take. Where did this giant finger come from? Well, as you walk around the piece, it gets better. Not really. Okay. You know, all the Hollywood gore has been unpacked for us, hasn't it? But look closer at the guts. There are pens and pencils of all kinds. Red pens and pencils of all kinds. And so suddenly this index finger begins to point to a very different kind of thing. Now, what on earth would a giant finger full of writing devices have to do with anything? Well, Tim Hawkinson doesn't leave us totally out in the cold. In the same gallery is this giant drawing, by the way, which we are told has been made from all those pins that are now inserted in that index finger. And when you zoom in on it, you begin to see that it's almost like some kind of intestinal kind of growth and movement. But he tells you what it is. He has a plate. It is the wall chart of world history from earliest times to present. Does that help? No, that didn't mean either. So I went to the catalog, read the catalog, and it says that the red pens and pencils were used to make the drawing of the wall chart of world history from earliest times, and that the blood and gore of the severed fingertip becomes the history in which the rise and fall of world powers, kingdoms, dynasties, and empires are loosely depicted. They caught that as intestinal structures growing, thriving, diminishing, and dying. It would appear that this history of the world has been written from this index finger, from its very blood, from a larger-than-life fingertip, from a logos made flesh, the word, the writing, the word made flesh. When discussing the logos' incarnation, this text that becomes flesh, Jesus as God is just outrageous. And as a matter of fact, maybe this isn't outrageous enough when we think about the incarnation. That God becomes a messy human with a messy manger birth, a messy sweating and bleeding person who died the messiest of deaths. He doesn't walk around the mess. He takes it head on. Now that's outrageous and extravagant. And maybe I get a little too sanitized about that. I know, sitting thinking about communion, and I think about he bled for me. Actually, this fingertip helps me in communion to think about how outrageous this is. That the one who writes world history did get his finger chopped off. I mean, it's worse than that, but somehow it seems more palpable to me, more present. And I like that detail of the dirty fingernail. You know, that God got involved with us. Even in creation, the creation text, he gets involved in the dirt and builds a human. Well, index also has an interesting pun to it. The original sense, which meant to point or pointer, figuratively something that serves to point to a fact or a conclusion. This finger is pointing to history, a history that has been rewritten by Jesus' blood. Hence the topics of a list in the back of a book being called Index. Well, I was dumbfounded to discover that this was not an outsider after all. This was a member of Christians in the Visual Arts who had had a Whitney retrospective. This is about the same thing as getting a gold medal in the Olympics. This is a big deal. And I haven't bumped into a lot of professing Christians who have made it to that kind of a venue. And so I was flabbergasted that I'd always been struck by his work, had always had a resonance to his work. His work always made me think about spiritual things. And turns out, well, he is too. And so I had a kind of a Mayus moment there, where did not my heart burn within me when I looked at the dirty fingernail? Well, something like that. Not quite that dramatic. But the idea here is that, hey, what else am I missing? Are there others out there who, if the Spirit has been poured out on all flesh, as Peter tells us in Acts 2, how much flesh? All flesh? Really? No, surely not. Surely just some flesh. That has been a challenging notion to me. That Jesus said in John that when he... Yeah. Oh, more technological.
The mic is on. So we'll have... All right.
Okay, good. So if you're just now joining us from the technological point of view, we've been looking at dirty fingernails. When Jesus said, hey, it's a good thing I go, because I'm going to send the Comforter. And you know, by the way, one of the things he's going to do, he'll comfort you by convicting the world of sin. Well, how does a world get convicted by sin? Is it only from us standing on the street corner saying, bad sinners? Or is there another way? Is the Spirit actually working in the unsaved, actually convicting them of truth about how they might understand what is the good and the beautiful, to discern it, really training them? So I begin to wonder if Tim Hawkinson's work, an Emmaus moment, by the way, this is what got me really thinking, okay, he's got to be on the inside. When you walk up on it, it's a huge image, but when you walk up on it, there's four levels of hands that have been branched together, really bizarre image, and there is the artist's hands. And you follow the branching down to these real little bitty hands, and they spell things with their hands, like, you know, not sign language, but, you know, kind of the pretend sign language. And it says love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness. And the title is fruit. So this idea of the fruit of your hands, the fruit of your action, I don't know what the fourth generation of hands, if that has anything to do with it or not. Maybe our resident theologian will be able to enlighten us. But there's this strangeness that I begin to wonder if all flesh is poured, if the Spirit has been poured out on all flesh, should we not be expecting donkeys to preach? Is there not a situation in which absolutely the profane can give us a sermon that can move us closer to God? And if I can begin to be a detector of that, begin to, in an aesthetic approach, begin to open myself to what even a secular artist has opened himself. I just love that image of the mute donkey speaking with the voice of a man to restrain the madness of the prophet Balaam. And so maybe this may be the bottom level case, and maybe I'm not exactly trying to call all secular artists donkeys. But if a donkey can restrain the madness, can the art of the unbeliever tell us something about God that we couldn't have gotten any other way? Is there a redeeming moment in this? Well, this is a work by Tara Donovan. In no way, shape, or form, you know, looked into this. You know, after Tim Hawkins, I began to get kind of suspicious. You know, every time I had a resonance with a piece, maybe they're a Christian. She's not. Seems to be agnostic at best. And this is a very odd artwork. You walk in and you think, hey, this is an empty room. Not really much here. And then you begin to look more closely at the walls, and they seem to have this kind of rippling, strange property. And then you begin to notice this high-pitched whistle. And it's not just one whistle, it's a lot of them. It's very gentle, very quiet. And as you walk up closer to it, you suddenly realize this is a wall of soda straws. Millions of them have been packed, one on top of the other, in such a way that they are wedged into an indomitable tightness, to quote Winnie the Pooh, and that the little variations are where an army of helpers have stacked these millions and millions of drinking straws, the transparent, clear kind. So, what is that about? You know, is that seems to be a kind of extravagant, outrageous wastefulness almost, you know, all this plastic crammed in here. Well, what's odd about it is that whistling you suddenly begin to realize is the little gentle air currents in the room passing over the straw. You ever done that on a bottle where you can, the same seems to happen with this, especially the fact that some are sticking out further, you get a little bit different tone than others. And it's like this strange whispering whistle that makes you extremely aware of the slightest movement of air. As a matter of fact, you change the whistle as you walk up on it, and you push air into it, and the air comes back out and bounces off of you. Also, a very odd thing happens. A strange pattern pulsates across this. As you move around, you can see into each one of those empty straws, and it creates this strange mosaic that's constantly pulsating and rippling. What began as an empty room is now a room absolutely alive and vibrant, and it is filled with an air that absolutely transforms these little empty tubes. Well, I don't know about you, but when Jesus talks about the Holy Spirit, and all through the Bible, the breath, the wind spirit of God is mentioned. And I just can't get away. This was one of the most prayerful spaces I've ever been in. Almost hearing the sighs of the Spirit praying for us in a language deeper than we can ever come up. Also, the fact that it took a community to build this, that each empty individual kind of meaningless straw by itself could in no way really transpose this space. But when you got them all together, you had to pay attention. And you really had to be in front of this thing. The slides just, it is a space filled with some kind of vibrant pattern that you cannot deny. It's just amazing. Well, this idea of the wordless sighs is what came up. I really like the Message translation. Aching groans. I'm beginning to identify with that more and more as I age. Okay. This is something that I got to live firsthand last night. Creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of Him who subjected it in hope. Did you catch that? Hopeful futility. My computer, it's only 3 weeks old, crashed last night at midnight as I was putting the finishing touches on the talk. And so I got to stay up till 3 in the morning redoing the whole talk. Hey, it could have been worse. The images were out there on the internet. That's great. So what about that futility? Is that actually something I was supposed to be exultant in and happy about? That's not usually how I feel in the moment. What do you interpret from an artist who works with such pointillistic work as this? Can you see the man and the... He's actually copying a Romanticist artist of the 1800s, Caspar Friedrich, and I'm actually hiding part of the image from you. This is the whole image in which you now understand what the pointillist medium is. Cigarette ashes, cigarette butts, matches. Vic Muniz has taken a Romanticist image of transcendence. The title of the one on the right from the 1800s is Wanderer Above the Mists, in which the individual is contemplating the grand, sublime nature landscape that falls before him. Well, what is Vic Muniz contemplating? An ashtray? What on earth is this artist doing to our masterpieces in our museums? Taking the remains and the ashes, the trash and the filth, and making an artwork that's supposed to be in a museum from it. The idea here is that, well, yeah, it could be an ironic statement. You know, postmodernity loves irony. And so I can really get it. You know, look at what your sublime, transcendent, individualistic experience is built on. All that trash. It's really worth nothing. It's ultimately a nihilistic proposition. Except for when I saw Vic Muniz's retrospective, he had hundreds and hundreds of works like this. And I can't believe that sarcasm and cynicism actually supported the creative effort for that long with those many pieces. It just didn't seem to make sense. He seems to be delighting in this material. I mean, look what he does. He really looks at the grayscale when he works with the ashes. He knows exactly what this stuff can do. He knows how these forms can create that rocky crag or a finer mist of ashes can generate that sublime landscape in the background. Is this a phoenix rising from the ashes that makes it all the more amazing? I think that the idea that the phoenix-type experience makes a transcendence all the more wondrous, a true miracle of paradoxical substance. We are made to be present in the scene. Look at these particulars. Notice that here there is an aggregation, a composite of figures, gritty and cast off, yet palpable and present. So where is the sublime? Is it not canceled by such trash, filth, and muck? Well, yes, except for the delight, the beautiful range of grays, the complex pointillistic potential of this burnt medium. With such attention and devotion to the ignored and the devalued, this substance is transmuted, an alchemist's conveyance from trash can to museum wall. Furthermore, the ghost of the Romanticist painting has been breathed new life. In the original, Caspar David Friedrich creates a man firmly planted on a real rocky perch, looking into the abyss of the formless. Does the material change make a difference? In other words, is this a new work now, or is this just a mere imitation and aping with a new material? Or is there something that's happened because Muniz has decided to use ashes? Well, in Friedrich's work, we see a detached observer contemplating, yet lacking participation. Look at that, how completely alien he is in this landscape. A sophisticated dandy with cane contemplating this rustic, formless form in front of him. But in Muniz's work, the fog and the man are made of the same stuff. There is a material participation between the man and the observed. Does this remind you of God and the Incarnation and how He becomes materially participatory in His creation? He's not a detached observer. He is infiltrating it so that He can change it. So, I want to talk about that futility thing. And this strange, strange thing that seems to happen when one is engaged in futility, that creation is actually subjected into futility for hope, that out of that, a new thing begins to spring open. I begin to wonder if I have the right to be protected from the mess. Do I have the right to be protected from the mess of the world? Should I go ahead and go with that avoidance of messiness, or at least the pain and frustration that mess brings to my expectations? Well, to be subjected to futility out of hope, Paul in Romans suggests that to be protected from the mess amounts to slavery. That we can't be protected from it and be free at the same time. So when I say it's my right to be protected from frustration, and I got to admit that's how I felt last night at 3 in the morning, wrestling with the computers, that I'm actually saying it's my right to be enslaved. And that's true. God will absolutely allow me to be enslaved. I have that free will choice. But I can't seem to extract myself from the mess. Demanding my rights can lead me to some bad places. And I think thinking about what the Pharisees were about, do you get this too? Jesus was not real happy with them. That the Pharisees, it really shocked me to learn what that word literally means. Have you ever heard what a Pharisee literally is? The word means the separate ones. Those who are separate. Separate from the mess? Well, we have some archaeological evidence that that's the case. They built sidewalks that allowed them to go over the marketplace on their way to the temple so that they would not be defiled by the mess of humanity that was there. Apparently, Jesus embraces our messiness and calls us to embrace the messiness of the world. Not to wallow in it, but to transform it. It's sort of like the passage in John 9, where the disciples are walking along, they see a blind man, hey, who sinned here? And Jesus says, no one sinned. This is exactly how it's supposed to be right now. As a matter of fact, this is set up for a really big deal. It's about to happen. We're about to see some glory in this mess. And what does Jesus do to transform the mess? Well, in my opinion, he makes some more mess. He spits on the ground and starts playing in the mud and then smears it on the guy's eyes. Wait a minute, you're going the wrong direction here. You need to purify this guy's eyes. You don't need to be messing. I mean, do you know how many germs are in that? I mean, goodness, you're spitting and you're... I mean, this is... What kind of medical treatment is this anyway? This is bizarre. And he goes and wash. And a very odd thing happens, doesn't it? A blind man begins to testify to the separate ones, to the Pharisees, who this Jesus is, that he didn't even know his name. And he was already preaching about him. An amazing thing indeed. Well, the idea that maybe I don't know what's best, and an even more radical idea that everything's exactly the way it's supposed to be right now. But wait a minute. What about pain? What about suffering? What about frustration? Everything's exactly the way it's supposed to be right now. That doesn't mean things aren't supposed to change, but things apparently are supposed to get bad before they get good. And that's a conversation I'd like to enter in with Kevin about. So if you could join me up here. Since I only play a theologian on TV, I actually decided to bring a real theologian. And the idea of a discussion, which we would invite you to join in with us too, is what about that statement? What about this futility? Oh, this is kind of a... Yeah. What about hopeful futility? What about this exultant groaning that we hear about? What about living slaughtered animals? I know it says living sacrifices, but somehow the sacrifice concept and the gore of the index finger has escaped me. And I have to say living slaughters, even though that's probably bad grammar. And dependent conquerors? I mean, Romans is full of some of these strange paradoxes, isn't it? By the way, this is Vic Muniz as well. He's gone to a mechanic shop, and you can make out all the nuts and bolts, and here's a bucket. And this is Caravaggio's Narcissus. So this is probably about 30 feet by 20 feet, and then he's photographed it. So taking the, you know, do y'all have those cans full of the nuts and the bolts that you know, have been there so long, they've kind of rusted into a single, well, that's, he's made art out of that greasy, grimy junk. Well, I'm curious, Kevin, in terms of your scholarship, Have I overstepped any bounds here, or are there some different spins on some of these artworks you would take as a theologian?
Well, no, I don't think you've overstepped any bounds. In fact,
oh rats! I meant to.
As you were talking, I just kept thinking about something that I think art is particularly helpful in convicting us of, and that is that the.
I guess
there it is.
Oh, hello. No, I'm very self-conscious.
Well, that's what we're here for.
The church really has to stop pretending that she doesn't need the world. Our approach to evangelism and missions is problematic when we have this notion that the world needs us, but we don't need the world. And one of the things that this artwork powerfully communicates to me is how much I can learn from the world. That I must never forget that the world and I share a fallen nature. We share a fallen creation. And there is a great common denominator there that I think sometimes we slough over a little bit in our haste to show them how right we are and how wrong they are. Whereas it might be worthwhile to dwell a little bit more on that commonality, on their keen ability to perceive the fallenness of the world, which sometimes we might be a little too hasty to sugarcoat. We might one of the things Paul does in Romans is he spends 2.5 chapters dwelling on the bad news before entering into the good news. And when you think about it, 2.5 chapters of bad news is a lot for us because we're not accustomed to that. We want to get to Romans 8. We want to jump over 1 and 2 and get to Romans 8 where all the good stuff is. But can you really appreciate the beauty of the gospel without having honestly embraced and accepted the mess we have made of the world? Because when we realize the mess that we have made of the world, and then we realize that God has entered into that mess, and out of that mess is bringing it back to form, which when Kenny showed the two pictures, the romanticist painting redone, I was just struck by the fact that you don't know which direction the painting on the right is going. Is this all kind of crumbling down into ash? Or is it, as he suggested, is it a phoenix rising from the ashes? Is this a picture of God taking the mess that we have made and kind of like, it reminds me of the Valley of Dry Bones in Ezekiel 37. Yeah. The dry bones, the wind blows over it, and the bones come together and form skeletons, and then the dust comes around it and forms flesh, and then breathes into it and brings it back to life. And you kind of get this impression of that here. But also, you know, a painting is a compressed narrative, essentially. It's a snapshot of a... And the romanticist narrative by itself is pretty bland. I mean, I'm not an expert on when romanticism was in its heyday, but I imagine it corresponded somewhat with the Industrial Revolution and modernity. And look, human progress. I climbed this mountain by myself. There's nothing I can't do. You see, and now here's the postmodern perspective on that, and it changes the narrative, doesn't it? Where did that confidence get us? It entered us into a century of war, of destruction, where we came face to face with just how fragile we really are and how dependent we are on some power outside of ourselves to take this ash and bring it back to life.
Sounds like a futility that might lead us to a changed position.
Right. Now this artist, you said, is not a believer.
Yeah. Not going to find.
I mean, there's no. That's evidence. Brilliant. I mean, has he not captured the gospel? I mean, whether or not he meant to is kind of beside the point, right? Because what God says through his work trumps what he was saying through his work. But there's a real testimony here, I think, to at least part of the gospel and the way he's interacting with this work. And I learned something from that. And that gives me a point to start with someone with whom I'm trying to share my faith, is to say, you know what, you taught me truth, and I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And now, I've kind of empowered him to see, let's converse. Let me not just tell you where you're wrong and how you need to be changed, but how you've changed me, how you have enhanced my faith.
This, to me, is really the whole point of the law unto themselves idea, that there is a valuation to what I would otherwise overlook. And for me, if God is redeeming the world, if that is happening,
is it happening? Yeah, is it happening gradually? Can I actually watch it unfold? And the strange notion that maybe I could see God's kingdom breaking in the smallest of places is just an exciting. It gives me a new pair of glasses. You know, it just makes me see the world in a completely new way if I begin to realize that, hey, if I spend all my time looking for what's wrong, I may be missing all that is being made right in the world. Even when it's intuitively, that's the part of the law unto themselves I was fascinated by, that there's this intuitive, instinctual might be the wrong word. It doesn't seem to be as intentional and verbally thought out as we tend to think it has to be. That there's this other kind of dynamic. Well, let me open it up to you. Was there anything that struck you about any of these images or connections to Scripture?
Okay. You talked about observing, whether intentional or otherwise, observing in artists the spiritual. Is it possible that believers can use the mess and the groanings and the futility of the world as our medium? Can we be artists? Can we, in a practical way, use it as a medium?
Well, I would pass this off to Kevin, because tomorrow your talk is entitled...
Yeah, Gospel Graffiti is this the title of my talk tomorrow, where I'm talking about how that... sin is kind of a pivot point, a fulcrum, because on the one hand, you know, sin is the impetus behind the mess. On the other hand, sin is what drives us to Christ for the mess we've made to be transformed into something beautiful, like ashes being turned into an imitation of the paint. So I think our very lives are precisely what you're talking about. God does what you're saying. He sees beyond the mess to the possibility of a creative interaction between himself and the mess that transcends the mess. But it's not by brushing the mess aside and starting fresh like he did in the beginning. It's by using what's here. He refuses to give up on what's here. He will not do that. He will use what's here, and he will breathe new life into it, and something will emerge out of it that we never could have imagined. And he invites us to partner with him in that. So I think the answer to your question is yes, but we don't really want to strike off on our own and do that. We want to see where God is doing that in the world and join him. Join him in that creative enterprise that he is doing, until we work our way to Revelation 21, where we can say with John, "Behold, I saw a new heaven and a new earth." But we're part of that. He started with us. It's kind of interesting. The whole biblical story is like this in mirror image, where in the beginning, in Genesis 1, God created heaven and earth, and the end of that process was humanity. But in the new creation, he reverses it. He starts with a new humanity in Jesus Christ, and the end result of that is a new heaven and a new earth. So you have this flip image, this mirror image in Scripture, of where God kind of starts at the other end. He does that because he refuses to scrap the mess and create ex nihilo again like he did before. Instead, he joins us here as human and says, okay, let's take what we've got and let's move back towards new creation.
He gets his fingers dirty. Anything else? Was that responsive to that?
Seeing that we are not the artist but the medium, we are the medium.
Yeah. Yes, that's a very, very good way of putting it. Right. We are the mess.
Yeah.
We are the mess. And the Messiah, to use a pun, the Messiah...
As a message.
Yes. Yes. He loves messes because of what... He loves messes because it puts us at His mercy, which is exactly where He wants us. And because He can amaze us all with what He can do with that.
Yeah. You can't fill a cup that's already full. And so when I hear that futility might actually be a way of emptying me or getting me a little empty so that his love can be poured out on me, maybe that really, I don't know about you, but exulting in tribulations, I'm not there yet. I want to be there, but maybe that's when I begin to realize that the stones were right. You can't always get what you want, but when you try sometime, you just might find you get what you need. And I don't want to become comfortably numb, as Pink Floyd says. You know, instead, I want aesthetics. I don't want anesthetics. Because there's a bomb in Gilead. Okay, the pun's it's gone too far. Officially extended that to. Any other comments, questions? Observation. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for. Oh, yes. Yeah.
I was just going to say, you know, when you think of biblical history, God's always worked with fame, but I've never really thought much about art as part of that medium. Think through on a theological level,
where's that book?
Through the history of the Old Testament, you've got God working through Abraham, but you've also got God working through Melchizedek. And so, in the one sense, he's preparing, you know, the gospel for the world, but then on the other sense, he's preparing the world for the gospel. He's working both areas to bring about this message.
Kevin shared with me a quote that I think is dead on.
Yeah, and I've got a couple of them here.
And this we can end.
This is a good perspective, I think. This is a book, Theological Aesthetics, a Reader, by Geza Elsbeth Theisen. And she's reflecting on 20th century ideas of the interaction of theology and art. And she says, in the mid-century French priest and man of vision, Pierre-Raymond Régamé, devoted a whole book to the relationship between religion and the arts. He concluded, as Tillich, Rayner, and Dillenberger would also argue, that even the atheist or communist artist and those who have no connection with the church must be allowed to work for the church. In this way, he raised a central issue. It is not necessarily the religiosity of the artist that matters in creating a spiritual or even a sacred work of art, but, strictly speaking, sacred art only requires a sacred character of the actual artistic creation of the artist's exercise of his or her art. So an interesting point of view there on how whether or not a so-called secular artist realizes it, he or she can become a medium for God's message. And maybe what needs to happen is the believer and the unbeliever need to come together and we need to say, do you know what your art testifies to? Mm-hmm. Because they may not know what their art really testifies to. And we can show them the transcendence of their own art. Now, wouldn't that be a cool place to start a conversation of faith? That something came out of them that originated with God. That the Imago Dei, the image of God, is still intact in them. As distorted as it might be, it's still there. Now, one other. Let me give the one from... hold that for just a second. Because I really like the way Madeline Lingle says... something I think very similar. Let me make sure I've got the right section here. Oh, she says, but how difficult it is for us not to judge, to make what in the current jargon is called a value judgment. And here we blunder into paradox again. Jesus says, judge not that you be not judged. And yet daily we must make decisions which involve judgments. And then she goes on to say that... It's not that we judge great works of art, it's that they judge us. And I think that's an interesting statement, that in a real way, art can do that. Even so-called secular art can pronounce judgment upon sin. It can pronounce judgment upon the church when the church is not rising to the calling that God has given her. And sometimes I think we need to hear that rebuke. But she mentions the same kind of thing, that when she says, when we look at a painting or hear a symphony or read a book and feel more named, then for us, that work is a work of Christian art. But to look at a work of art and then to make a judgment as to whether or not it is art or whether or not it is Christian is presumptuous. It is something we cannot know in any conclusive way. We can know only if it speaks within our own hearts and leads us to living more deeply with Christ in God.
Well, those are good words to... I knew I had you join me for a reason. thank you all so much for joining us. I'll end with The 30 Pieces of Silver by Cornelia Parker. Again, she's not a Christian, but these cast-off silver pieces have been flattened in industrial machinery and then hung and suspended just off the floor. It seems to suggest a table. What table would that be? Thank you for coming.
What do you think? Our fellow got off. He's taking calls. Isn't he? Thank you, Kenny.
Hey there. Right. Thank y'all for coming. Appreciate
that.
Appreciate your. Stay now.
Hey,
thank you.
What's your name? My name's Ben Miller. My grandmother went going to free art museums around, and lots of the free ones have a lot of modern art around Houston.
Yeah.
Who's that? That chapel. Rocco?
Yeah,
that was it. And first year, and I don't know much.
Yeah, what's up? What's up?
Yeah. And it's like an iPod.
I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. I say it's like three more. There's like a Trinity, and there's all the religious material for you to read as you look at it. And I kind of thought, that'd be sad if that's the only way you're going to thank God is just a big black thing. I understand, and that's
interpretation.
I interpret it to be like that's.
Can really
give you
each other. Yeah, I think
Scripture can be toward Christ came and see things gave a face. I mean, there was just
seem to have more of an
art.
But I think there's, I personally don't like Rocco's
so
work,
but
it is sort of like that one of straws. There was an attempt by the color-filled artists to create this field.
Tomorrow,
I like that. Wonder of mist, sort of
the
loss and absorb.
But
I have not been to that show. I just studied about it in books. Now he worked really closely with the architect. So I think in the sense that maybe his paintings don't work as well. I've heard the architecture and that relationship with all that was intentional.
The lighting,
yes,
and
I agree. Really adamant about the
lighting.
Fascinating.
Yeah, but then we went on vacation to Spain. This
part is
awesome.
It's like
really weird. Dali.
Exactly.
Realization.
No, he became a Christian. The last part of his life.
And his wife.
Yeah. She's Catholic. That's like kind of converted. Yeah. So that's
interesting.
Did you see a lot of his religious icons?
I've seen it in books, I like the crucifixion on a hypercube. That was great.
Yes, right. Yeah, that's
from
the most famous.
From a physicist's perspective.
Oh, are you a physicist?
Yeah, physics major.
Really?
Yep.
Well, there's one right there.
We need the.
He was just talking about how he's wanting to find someone of the more scientific bent to kind of.
We need this triumvirate of
to bring in the scientific perspective.
Art, theology.
You should have spoken up.
I really believe that this is kind of a deal. The aggregate way of working. So.
Did that guy do stuff with dust, dude? Last time he did a lot of stuff with dust. He was doing.
Yes,
he did dust.
Peanut butter.
He was doing empty rooms.
Oil. Yes.
It was like
yes.
The ultimate, like it seems to be
about
as low as
right? Or the photographs?
He always took photographs of empty rooms. Maybe this is someone else, but he made it look like empty rooms, but it was out of dust.
Were they suspended particles? Is that what you're...
It was just like that, except what it looked like was just a dirty empty room. Just an empty room with like dirt on the walls and like an outlet maybe or a crack on the wall. But yeah, it was dust from these rooms that he got. He
But you know this kind of Brian Greene idea of the granularity of space-time.
It's also like physics.
Well, that's what I'm saying, the granularity of space-time. I mean, the fact that space has a grain and that time has a grain.
Elementary particles.
I'm thinking the particle nature of this. There's absolutely another lectureship talk we could have about these same images that have to do with, and the thing that I'm fascinated by is Aggregate talks about the paradox between the nothingness of the particle and the somethingness of what it makes up. And this one's really playing that up, right? The nothingness, somethingness. You'd be late. You need to go to your...
I don't feel like going.
Don't feel like going?
No.
We put you so totally... We anesthetized you so completely. So, thanks for coming.
Oh, you're welcome.
Kenny, that was great. And we'd like to
know. Boy, what a turnout.
I know. Sitting room.
You had people sitting on the floor.
I'm sorry, I was late.
And that it always looks better, doesn't it, when it's that way. So, I have few chairs. So, I actually took some chairs out. So we did. Actually, we took two up here. Well, cool. Thank you so much. Boy, I was really struggling with an ending, but those quotes were perfect.
Well, we kind of did this morning.
He shared it with me this morning, and I said...
I read that paragraph from that one book this morning. I thought, wow, that's just right along the lines of what Kenny's getting at. And so he didn't really have time to incorporate it, but he said maybe we could just put that as part of the conversation.
I barely had time to incorporate my own ideas.
So I marked it and thought, at whatever point he cued me, I would...
Well, you performed well.
Well, your talk brought up a thought that that hadn't occurred to me before.
Me too.
That was this,
yeah.
Preach to yourself. How the church really needs to sit at the feet of the world sometimes too.
Yeah, boy.
Take the other position, which Jesus did.
I read a quote really similar to that, or I heard my coach say, I can't remember which, that we have got to get over the fact that we don't need the world. Who said that? It's an actual somebody saying, like Mother Teresa or something. I don't know.
I don't know.
That's powerful
maybe
stuff.
Because
that is what a Pharisee is. I'm separate. Don't need you.
Right.
You know. And now I kind of understand
it's denying that commonality, that common denominator, without which we can't talk to each other. We just can't.
Well, and it's what Landon Saunders said, that if you feel good giving to other people, shouldn't you be receiving? Wouldn't that be as much of a ministry to receive from someone who, because when you receive from someone, you're admitting, I'm dependent on you. I need from you.
I keep thinking of Jesus asking the woman at the well for water.
There you are. Yeah. There you are. Yeah, that's it.
What a way to start, to take the position of
I need
being
you. Yeah.
And not serve your people.
Yeah. Cool.
And to let it go from there.
I don't know how to turn this off.